This episode is brought to you by Fuli Gemstones.
What I think it's very fascinating for the visitors of the exhibition is that while the beautiful jewelry is for the body and for the person, here we also have silver masterpieces for the house and the galleries you are mentioning dedicated to the beauty of nature, of the earth and of the sea demonstrate amazing animals, leaves, centerpieces, mixing the silver, for example, with the Venini glasses. I love this idea to have a sort of eternal beauty for the jewelry as for the silver, for the person as for the house.
I'm Carol Walton, the voice of jewelry. Welcome to If Jewels Could Talk. I'm an author and broadcaster, and the woman who initiated the role of jewelry editor at magazines like Tatler and Vogue. This is a podcast for everyone, for people who do like jewelry, for people who don't realise they like jewelry, and anyone intrigued by fascinating facts, new ideas and forgotten histories. So join me as I tell sparkly tales and meet all sorts of people, delving into four centuries of jewelry culture, and investigate what's happening now. I'm in Venice for the opening of a new exhibition, The Prince of Goldsmiths, Rediscovering the Classics. And I'm here with Alba Capiglieri, who's an author, historian, the head of jewellery at the Milan Polytechnic. And she's curator of this exhibition, which I've been the first person to see. If Jewels Could Talk was first in the door, very exciting. And it's really, really something sensational. We're here by the lagoon in the old Fortuny factory where the exhibition is being held. And Alba, why here? Why did Buccellati want to show in Venice?
Carol, first of all, let me thank you so much. I really love your podcast. If Jewelry Could Talk is my favorite podcast, and I'm very honored to be with you and with your listeners. We are in Venice because there is, first of all, Venice is the place to be right now for the Biennale of Arts. So it's a very important location for the arts right now. And Buccellati expresses the beauty of the art of jewelry. First, actually, there are many relationships between Buccellati and Venice because Margherita Sarfatti, she was one of the most important female cultural figures of the beginning of the century. She started from Venice to Milan, and she was the one who brought Gabriele D'Annunzio in Milan, where he met Mario Buccellati.
The famous poet.
The super famous poet. He was also a war hero. He was a writer. And he was what today we could define an influencer. He defined himself, I am a man of luxury. Mm-hmm. And he was really fond about the beauty of the world. He had many beautiful muses. He used to stay and to work together with some of the most beautiful women of the beginning of the century.
So he was an influencer and a bit of a playboy.
Yes, correct. Exactly. He was a very fascinating figure.
Mm-hmm. So Rediscovering the Classics revolves around the beginning, which was Mario Buccellati. The brand took its name from his name. He opened his first store near La Scala Opera in Milan in 1919. And he basically is the 20th century jeweller who gave his name to a style.
Yes, Mario Buccellati was one of the great Italian masters of jewelry of the 20th century. Someone who knew exactly how to interpret the wonderful all traditional goldsmith techniques of the past, but with a contemporary spirit. And this is exactly what we try to do with this exhibition in Venice, to start a comparison between four different Buccellati generations in order to see their coherence. And his jewelry, his silverware, and all his precious objects, as you were mentioning, a very, very distinctive style, so much that he started the Buccellati style. And Mario was also an extraordinary man, and in Italian we call them homines novi, new men, the new men of the beginning of the centuries. They were basically entrepreneurs, scientists, writers who started a new way of considering time, and especially the homines novi were the reason why Milano became the economical capital of Italy. And it was an amazing metropolis at the beginning of the century. Can you imagine? Mario was born in 1892, and his father passed away when he was only 5. And his mother was a very young widow with 4 little kids, and she decided to move from Brony to Milan for offering to their kids more opportunities. And in Milan, Mario got an apprenticeship from 2 very famous and traditional goldsmiths, mm-hmm. Besnati and Beltrami. He was only 11,
wow.
12, and he started learning everything. He learned how to create jewelry, but he also learned how to deal with clients. He learned the taste of clients. He learned how to set up a store. He learned how to work with craftsmen. He learned everything. Then, when the First World War arrived and he went in the war, he came back and he asked to Mr. Besnati to start a new business together. Mr. Besnati said, "No, I'm sorry, Mario. I don't believe Italy will be able to go over the post-war." And Mario was very young and he said, "I think Italy will overcome the post-war." He bought the store from Mr. Besnati in Santa Margherita, which was very...
he had saved his salary. He had
everything. Yes, yeah. And he started his own business as Mario Buccellati Jewelry and Silverware Object of Art. Mm-hmm. From 1919, he decided immediately which was his goal, which was his purpose, to create artistical jewelry and objects. His wife was fantastic, and she used to say, "He does everything. He creates the jewelry and the silver pieces. He talks with the clients. He talks with the craftsmen. He does everything." But Mario was not just an amazing creator of jewelry and silverware. He was also a visionary in terms of entrepreneurship. After Milano, he opened up 2 stores, one in Florence and one in Rome, and together with Salvatore Ferragamo, he was the very first Italian to open a store in Manhattan, in New York, in 1951, and then 1 year later, in Palm Beach. Can mm-hmm. you imagine, without speaking a word of English, yeah. how brave he was in understanding the taste of people, in understanding new markets.
And was he taking that Italian taste to America?
Yes.
Did the stores resemble each other?
Yes, they were all the same, exactly as they are today, with a very Italian allure. And in the same field, Gian Maria, his son, he did exactly the same things. Opening not to America, but opening to the East Market. And Gian Maria was the very first one to open a store in Place Vendôme. So the very first Italian jeweler mm-hmm. with the ability to open in mm-hmm. Place Vendôme. It's an amazing story, Buccellati.
Is it true that when he really came into the public's eye was in 1920 at an exhibition in Madrid.
Yes.
And a woman came in and said, could I have a discount?
Yes.
Is that true?
Yeah.
And will you say what happened?
Yes, it is true. It is a little bit different. In 1921, he went to Madrid and he met the royal family and they became his clients. Then he became famous. And in the store in Milano came a lady asking for a discount. And he said, I'm not a seller. I'm an artist.
I'm not a tradesman.
Yes.
I'm not a tradesman. Yeah. And sort of threw her out. And then everybody wanted to come and see him and see his pieces.
Yes. Also because, Carol, there is another beautiful story which brings us to Gabriele D'Annunzio, that at the very beginning, Mario... he used to do wonderful drawings because he had no possibility to create many precious jewelry. So... he used to display in his vitrines just drawings. And this was also a very innovative way of presenting and communicating its work. And when he met Gabriele D'Annunzio in 1922, D'Annunzio was having a walk around the Scala Theater, and he was very curious to know why this man is presenting just drawings. Mm-hmm. And he got in and he said, what is this drawing? And Mario replied, these are dreams.
Oh, that's so nice.
And I think he understood very well the essence of jewelry, to be desirable, to be a dream, and so not just something physical. And this is very related, in my opinion, to the Italian creativity, the ability to transform a problem into an opportunity.
I want to just define this style he created, because essentially it's such fine Italian goldsmithing that everything produced seems to resemble a fabric, sort of linen, silk. Yeah. So finely worked. How do you describe his style?
The Buccellati style, first of all, is an artistical style, because all the Buccellati generations, from Mario to Gianmaria to Andrea and Lucrezia right now, they used to start from the legacy of the best Italian traditional goldsmithing techniques. So going back to the Greek's time, to the Roman's time, Middle Ages, Renaissance, they reinvented some amazing techniques, like, for example, the engraving, the lace, honeycomb, enchaining, and so on.
The honeycomb is just that finely worked, it's almost like gold wire work, that you can see the spaces.
You can see the spaces. It is treated with a silk lace inside the hole. It requires so much time to do every single piece and the great skills from the Buccellati craftsmen.
And the enchaining is... very fine chains around.
Yes, the enchaining could be or big chains, like, for example, the Hawaii collection, or, as in some parures we are presenting at the exhibition, very, very small, with these amazing edges, with diamonds, or with these particular treatments. And history is very important for Buccellati history. As a formal reference, they are looking back to the history of the arts from the Renaissance to Neoclassicism, and also as technique. For example, their peculiar techniques, from rigato to segrinato to modellato to ornato, they are reinterpretations of the ancient Italian techniques. And also the Buccellati style is based on some codes, like, for example, the combination of silver with gold, like edges very fine crafted, or like, for example, diamond with the old cut with the rose cut. So what I think, what I love, I'm studying the Buccellati story and art pieces from many years, and what I, anytime I'm surprised by their evolutionary ability. I realized that while other brands, other jewelry brands, especially when they are purchased by big companies or groups of luxury, they change radically creative and management direction. While for in Buccellati, we do not have any revolution, but we have a very strong evolution according to the spirit of time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this ability to keep together the past with the present and looking ahead to the future is pretty unique and is the main purpose of this exhibition. How the present and the future are melted with the past.
Mm-hmm. So was it Gian Maria who started doing the accessories, these exquisite little compacts and bags with jewels, and they look like silk, they're so finely worked?
If we go deeper in the mm-hmm. history of Buccellati, we will find that any creative director, Mario, Gian Maria and Andrea, they have a peculiarity in terms of style, but also in terms of new objects. So what we call gallantry, were small vanity cases, cigarette cases, boxes. Mm-hmm. They were very famous at the beginning of the century because they belonged to the elegant men and women. So Mario was the first one who introduced these beautiful boxes, basically realized for Gabriele D'Annunzio and his friends and his muses. But then Gian Maria was incredibly good also in understanding a new type, mm-hmm. new time, which are the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. So different object, one of a kind. For example, Gian Maria created some really incredible vases and sculpture, one of a kind, spending years on the details. So the idea of understanding its time, but also to have something eternal.
But the bags were then, you wouldn't have an evolution now at Buccellati to make little accessories like that.
Not no, because unfortunately we have lost this elegance.
Yeah, nobody buys them.
Nobody. Unfortunately, we don't go at the theater very well dressed. And this is the lack of elegance of our contemporary mm-hmm. times. Mm-hmm. But Mario Buccellati, at the beginning, all the most important jewels and accessories of the Milanese style were realized by him. Mm. And he was the perfect interpreter, not only of a new kind of jewelry, but also of the Milanese style. Milanese style is related to a very soft elegance, nothing shouted, a great discretion. As Milan, Milan is a city of an inner beauty, nothing too evident, nothing too big. Mm. Is the essence of elegance.
So I was really struck by the Mario's pieces that he made for Gabriele D'Annunzio. Will you tell us a little about that relationship?
Yes.
And how that evolved? Because these pieces are extraordinary.
And also is a pretty unique relationship in the history of jewelry, mm. linking literature with jewelry. But Mario and Gabriele D'Annunzio, they were not just client and goldsmith. They were friends. Mm. And they met in 1922 and they had a very long correspondency of 83 letters we have at the archive. And this long relationship lasted until Gabriele D'Annunzio died in 1938.
And he was the one who named Mario Buccellati the Prince of Goldsmiths.
Correct.
And how was that? How did that happen?
It happened in 1936 during his last letter, and because Gabriele D'Annunzio wrote amazing letters to Mario. And also when Mario's mother passed away, he was very sad, and D'Annunzio wrote a very sentimental letter to Mario saying, don't worry, Mario, our moms will be always with us. So it's not just a client relationship. And Gabriele D'Annunzio asked Mario to create many objects, daily objects for his friends, for example, many, many boxes. Some of them are at the exhibition. And Gabriele D'Annunzio, since he was a poet, he invented many mottos, for example, like memento auder semper, that means do not forget, always to risk. And they were beautiful mottos engraved on the boxes by Mario. And Mario D'Annunzio asked for some specific pieces, and Gabriele and Mario realized them. And many of these jewels were for some of the most beautiful women of the century. Mario realized amazing pieces for Isadora Duncan, for the Marchesa Cassati. She was a very eccentric
woman. Who lived in the Peggy Guggenheim Museum.
Yes, and also she moved to Paris, and she was a very... Or Tamara de Limpisca, the painter. Some of the most beautiful and important women of the beginning of the century.
Were these women that Gabrielle was having a relationship with at the time?
Sometime, yes.
He admired.
He had a very long correspondence with them. He was a very fascinating man, and he was adored by women. So, for many women, Mario realized beautiful object. But Gabriele D'Annunzio was a very generous man, so he used to give gift and presents to everyone visiting him at Vittoriale. And Mario realized some daily objects in silver with colored gemstones for him, but also, and this is a quite nice story because almost no one knows that the very first piece that Mario realized for Gabriele D'Annunzio was not a jewel, but was a piece, the restoration of a very ancient glass. And Mario was so skilled and so good in restoring this glass, and Gabriele D'Annunzio said, "You are the best." So, starting from this, Gabriele D'Annunzio asked Mario to create the Vittoriale, which was the place where he used to live in, style. And in this way, Mario became the Prince of Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. But Mario also realized very precious jewelry for Gabriele D'Annunzio. For example, the wedding gift that Gabriele D'Annunzio gave are beautiful tiaras with diamonds and pearls by Mario. So both one-of-a-kind high jewelry pieces as, let's say, prêt-à-porter jewelry for his friends and muses. It's an amazing story, the relationship between Mario and Gabriele, absolutely unique.
The tiara in the exhibition, the small, yes. This is silver with gold inside and
yes.
Pearls. It's absolutely beautiful in a sort of honeycomb
technique. Yes.
Who was that made for? Do we know?
Not yet, but it presents a great peculiarity, which was to have the silver outside and the yellow gold inside. Mm. This is an incredible sign of elegance because in this way, the skin is protected by the gold, but there is also another reason because the silver gets black and so gives depth to the pearls, to the rose-cut diamonds. Super chic jewelry.
Very chic.
Yes.
You know, your eyes completely drawn to it, to these early pieces.
Yes.
They are extraordinary. But what I'm interested in also is in rediscovering the classics because it's going back to this, you know, Renaissance inspiration of goldsmithing. The tools that are used now to create these modern pieces, are they the same that we used during the Renaissance?
In some cases, yes. But what's very interesting is that Mario and then Gian Maria and now Andrea, they created new tools for example, for engraving. They created new burins for engraving, and they
created... A burin is
the tool for engraving, and also for getting this effect of silk with these very thin lines. They are very good. What I think it's very interesting also for our listener is the ability to, they know very well how to use the techniques, but they innovate them for getting the final effect they wish to have. And this is really of the great goldsmith of the past, like Benvenuto Cellini was, for example, studied a lot from both Mario and Gian Maria and Andrea. We can see the best Italian tradition with a very contemporary style in the Buccellati creation.
So what did they change in the burin? Did they just make it so it could be finer, more delicate?
For example, if you give a look to all the Macri collection, for example, you can see that all the lines are very, very thin and they are very regular. This is impossible to get with traditional burins, for example. So they created special burins for getting this effect. They are extremely soft. One of my favorite techniques, both with the engraving, is the lace technique and the honeycomb technique. And looking at their craftsmen working with this technique is so fascinating and special. You really understand the beauty and the wonders of the man-made.
And so can young apprentices now use this burin in the way that Buccellati want, or does it take a long time?
It will take a very long time because, generally speaking, the apprenticeship of a Buccellati engraver requires at least 1 year. After 1 year, they can start working on the simplest object. After 5 years, on the middle complex objects, and only after 10 years, on the eye jewelry. And I understand why, because they are so unique and special and very, very difficult to create.
And there are two very long vitrines either side of the exhibition space filled with silver. And one is inspiration from the sea and the other is fruits and flowers and botany. I think the Buccellati technique is very important here as well to create the fur and feathers of the animals and the fruits and vegetables.
Nature has always been a very important inspiration for all the Buccellati generations. And Mario fell in love with the silverware. And what I think it's very fascinating for the visitors of the exhibition is that while the beautiful jewelry is for the body and for the person, here we also have silver masterpieces for the house and the galleries you were mentioning, dedicated to the beauty of nature, of the earth and of the sea, demonstrate, like in the past as in the present, we have amazing animals, leaves, centerpieces, mixing the silver, for example, with the Venini glasses in a very contemporary collection. So I love this idea to have a sort of eternal beauty for the jewelry as for the silver, for the person as for the house.
Yeah, that sort of velvety texture of leaves. Yeah. The leaves look real thorny fruits, little prickly tufts on acorns.
They look alive.
Yes, they do.
Yes.
And why was Mario, why did he fall in love with silverware?
At the time, at the beginning of the century, silver was very fashionable, also for jewelry. But Mario was by far a visionary. He realized that also silver cups, a silver object for the house, were extremely important. And exactly as for the jewelry, he interpreted also silverware object in a contemporary way. And Andrea, for example, he used to say that right now engraving is only and just mechanical, because of course it's cheaper, while at Buccellati engraving is still handmade. Mm-hmm. And this gives to their object a very special touch, a very special feeling, and a very special beauty.
They do. So with the silver objects, I hope then that we still want an elegance in the home. It won't be like the bags,
yes,
that they'll just disappear from use. Do you think people still want to have these rather elaborate? Some of them are practical, some of them are purely decorative. You know, lovely monkeys or reindeer or great big soup tureens with great mounds of fruit and vegetables on top. Do you think people will still be decorating their house with these?
I think yes. Mm-hmm. And I think that these objects are objects of art. So if people love to collect art, they will love these pieces. But I also believe in the education of beauty. So mm-hmm. I love to curate exhibitions because I think that if we educate, especially our youngest generation, to the beauty of these art objects, they will learn to live well. Mm-hmm. So I think that in the Buccellati objects, there is a deep educational value towards beauty.
And you can start small. I mean, they're little leaves with the, yes, sort of variegated, yes, veins running through that look like a little drop leaf from a tree outside, but it happens to be in silver. And yes, these are just small little objects that really make the most fantastic addition to a tabletop and great gifts.
Yes. This is a success coming from Gino Buccellati. Gino Buccellati is together with Andrea and Maria Cristina, the son of Gian Maria, and they purchased a company of silverware expressly for the best cutlery and the leaves. So they started from the real leaves to offer these very naturalistic and real effect. So I think that everyone should know and appreciate a Buccellati object, from the little one to the big one of a kind.
Which is your favorite piece in the exhibition, Alba?
Oh, this is very hard to tell you because I really, my favorite element of the exhibition is the comparison in terms of generation, demonstrating this rediscovery of the classic.
So as you walk into the exhibition,
yes,
you have a long cabinet and only four pieces of jewelry in it.
Yes.
Will you explain what those are?
Yes, because the very first pieces that our visitors will meet are four butterflies, realized the first one by Mario, the second one by Gian Maria, the third one by Andrea, and the fourth one by Andrea and Lucrezia. She is Andrea's daughter. And in a very single object like a butterfly, you can perfectly understand the evolution of the style. So, for example, Mario and Gian Maria, butterflies, they have in common the Baroque pearls of the body of the butterfly, and very different treatments for the finishing and the techniques of the wings, while the last one, the fourth one, we do not have the pearls anymore, but we do have a more abstract shape and aesthetics. And I think it's very interesting because in these four pieces, we have more than a century of the Buccellati story. And our visitors can appreciate the legacy and the little differences between one of another. So yes, the four butterflies are my favorite, but I also love the small objects realized for Gabriele D'Annunzio And for example, I'm passionate about the Macri collection and the Ombelicale necklace that Mario did for the first time for
that was
Gabriele.
Beautiful. Along with an amethyst drop at the bottom.
Yes, it's a very long chain that Gabriele D'Annunzio used to define collane allegre, nice necklaces, because they were realized in silver with colored gemstones, and they were supposed to be exactly on very long chains. So perfect for the beautiful dresses of the time, long dresses that Gabriele D'Annunzio used to give as a gift also to his muses.
Yes, because we don't see those very much now in the modern collection,
yeah.
Do we? But I wanted to go back to those four butterflies quickly.
Yes.
What we learn from them, as you said, the little tweaks of style for the different generations.
Yes.
And you can just tell in the sort of 1950s version how it's much more gemstone-led. It's a bit brighter. It's a bit bigger, as women were dressing then in that sort of last age of elegance.
Yes. Of course, we can see in the history of Buccellati, the history of the style of the 20th century, of course. So starting with Mario, we have the best deco style. The 30s style is a much thinner style related to jewelry, also in terms of colors. While when we turn to Gian Maria, for example, we have the big volumes of the 50s and the 60s, for example. We have two vitrines in the exhibition dedicated to cocktail rings and cocktail earrings, big gemstones full of colors, unusual cut, very heavy and bold, while on the other end, Mario jewelry was smaller one. And the third evolution, the one by Andrea, which I find very sophisticated, because is a little bit more abstract in terms of style, but with a depth of detail really unbelievable. If you look at the edges, for example, of Andrea Buccellati cuffs or the parure, are simply amazing. So for me, it's really the bridge between the founder and the present.
And Lucrezia now, who's the daughter of Andrea, how old is Lucrezia? She's young, isn't she?
She's quite young, actually, even though not so young, because she's married, she has kids.
I think the first time I met her, she was so young.
Yes, and she lives in New York.
Yes.
And she works a lot with her father, Andrea, contributing a lot to the evolution and the design of the Buccellati style.
And so that keeps it.
Yes. And also, I'm very happy because she's the very first female designer at Buccellati.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
Bringing a touch of
what was feminine. Her piece in the exhibition? She's got a few that were inspired by her?
Yeah, we have some pieces, especially related, for example, to the engraving technique done together with Andrea. But I think that her masterpieces is the last butterfly in the first room.
Yes. And so it's a way that Buccellati can keep resonating with the new generations.
Yes.
So it's probably pretty important to have a young female designer.
I think so, yes. Yeah. And also it's very important to always be very captive towards the signals of the present and to understand the time we are living, because especially for jewellery, it's a very difficult time.
It's a very difficult time. And as you say, I think what's good about it is the rediscovery of the classic, because I think that's what people want.
Yes.
Because you want to have something that's timeless, that if you are going to invest in a piece, you're always going to want to wear it. So you don't want something that's too
fashionable.
Too fashionably led.
You are right, Carol, but you know, this is, from my perspective, the problem of jewelry. Because it's true, you want something eternal, but at the same time, you also want something you like to wear with your couture and with your dress now. So the problem now, especially for high jewelry, for me, is to connect very different times. It should be eternal, but it should also be ephemeral in terms of fashionable and glamorous. So this is the reason why, especially after the pandemic, high jewelry is having this big success, because people can have an investment but also an ornament at the same time. Mm-hmm. And this is fascinating and also full of hope for the jewelry market, while for the prêt-à-porter jewelry, things are going worst.
And also, I think people want to connect with something that they feel has some emotional value,
yes,
especially after the pandemic, do you think?
Yes, definitely. And I think that it's very interesting how fashion brands are entering in the high jewelry couture, and at the same time, the evolution of jewelry brands towards a more contemporary high jewelry pieces and collections.
How do your students view jewelry? How do they view it when they speak to you? Do they view it as something like an art object to learn about the past, or do they view it as something living that we all are invested in now?
The first question I ask to the class every year is, what is jewelry for you? Mm-hmm. And any year I'm fascinated by their answers, because for many of them, jewelry is a sentimental object. So they truly look for jewelry with a sentimental value. That is not just something coming from their mother's homes and so on. It's something not related just to an accessories. So they are looking for meaningful jewelry. And I think this is very challenging for the industry now, to create jewelry with a meaning.
So you think because the industry is focused on big, glamorous gemstones or big pieces, it's not going to have that underlying meaning?
Yeah. I think that jewelry right now cannot be only big gemstones. Of course, big gemstones are very important in terms of investment. Mm. But even an investment, it's better if it has a sentimental value and some narrative values. So this is the reason why I think that French are so good in, especially for high jewelry, in bridging the legacy of the brand into contemporaneity. And we are learning a lot from the French Maison about this.
But that doesn't give sentimentality to the buyer. You'll know the brand values, but does that give sentimentality to the buyer?
If, and many Maison are able to do this, if you are able to transfer the sentimental value to the investment, it will be easier also, because it's not just finance, but is a precious object, even in terms of sentiments. And I think that right now what we have learned from the pandemic is to choose better what we want to have. And jewelry is very important in doing this.
I agree with that. But I do lament the loss of some beautiful jeweled objects that we don't do that now.
Yeah.
And like the Gabrielle D'Annunzio, in the little boxes, in his colours.
Yes.
Those were his hereditary colours, weren't they?
Yes, because Gabrielle D'Annunzio was appointed by the last king of Italy as the Principe, the Prince of Montenevoso, and his heraldic colours were the blue and the red. This is the reason why in many Buccellati creations, especially boxes, we will find in enamel the blue and red, and they are amazing even in terms of techniques. I do hope that we will go back to this kind of elegance also in terms of precious subject.
I hope we're
so.
Dreaming.
Yes, I hope so. And this is also the reason why to every kind of exhibition, I always bring my students saying, look at this, this was related to a vanity case or for cigarettes. So it would be nice to design new objects like this one.
And anyone can have their motto or a little saying or a little poem engraved on
yes,
anything.
Yes, absolutely. Also, this is very fashionable because it's related to customization. And since we know that luxury means be unique, so what's more unique than your initials engraved on a beautiful box?
Mm-hmm. How long is the exhibition on for, Alba?
It will last until June, so our listeners have time to see it. I hope so.
It's a good excuse to get to Venice.
Yes, to Venice is amazing and the exhibition is beautiful.
And see the Prince of Goldsmith. Thank you very much for walking us through the exhibition, Alba.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you for listening. For this and other episodes of If Jewels Could Talk, please go to our website, carolwilton.com/podcasts. We do have a new YouTube channel as well, so take a look at that. And you can reach me at Carol Wilton on Instagram. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please share it any way you can. Our If Jewels Could Talk community is increasing all the time. We're listened to in 149 countries now, which is amazing. So thank you for sharing it and keep on telling people if you've enjoyed it. Thank you. Now, I wanted to share with you some exciting news about the podcast. A while ago, I recorded a special episode on gold, and within it, I interview Charlie Betts of Single Mine Origin, which is allowing gold to be traced to mines that have the highest responsibility standards. They play a vital environmental and cultural support to local communities. The gold comes with a QR code, so customers know exactly where and how their gold was mined. It's a very important initiative. Now, because somebody heard them on the podcast, a brand in the US contacted me and wanted to be put in touch. And now through that, they have a distributor for SMO gold throughout the US. And they have manufacturing options to discuss and make viable for US jewelers. So that's a huge initiative that's come to fruition through the power of this podcast. And don't forget to join me again in 2 weeks for the next Jeweled Nugget. I'm absolutely thrilled that Ron Winston, the son of the legendary Harry Winston, will be joining us from his home in California. And we will be talking about the King of Diamonds, who happens to be his father, the American icon. There are few American success stories that rival that of Harry Winston, who was born Harry Weinstein in 1896. His parents were poor Jewish immigrants who started a small jewelry business in New York City. And we're going to find out what happened after that. And Ron is going to share his father's story as well as his own. And of course, we'll be talking a lot about diamonds. So join me then. You won't want to miss his stories. Bye-bye. If Jewels Could Talk with Carol Wilton is produced by Natasha Cowan, music and editing by Tim Thornton, graphics by Scott Bentley, illustration by Jordi Labanda. You can find our sponsors at fuligemstones.com and me at carolwilton.com.